many times is a kidney offered to a patient who ends up dying on the transplant list?
New treatment for major depressive disorders.
How are we doing with HPV vaccination in folks who don't get vaccinated?
And does ownership of the dialysis center affect access to kidney transplants?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on September 27th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I just want to remind our listeners that a couple weeks ago, we talked about a study, and it was comparing behavior in France versus the United States and discarding kidneys and how often that happens. And that if we adopted a behavior more like France's, we could probably reduce the number of people who are on transplant lists. So this week, we're talking about two more studies relative to kidney transplantation. And one that I found to be pretty outrageous, actually, is in JAMA Network Open, and this is an association between declined offers of deceased donor kidney allografts and outcomes in kidney transplant candidates. Whoa, that's a lot of stuff, right? What's this all mean? It means that folks who are on the transplant list, actually the behavior is that the UNOS, United Network for Organ Sharing, says, okay, we've got this kidney and you can have it. What happens is they can either accept this proffered organ or not, and then have a transplantation. And so this is a cohort study that took a look at all of this data from all deceased donor kidney offers in the United States between January 1, 2008 and December 2015. They had outcomes that included receiving a deceased donor allograft, receiving a living donor allograft, dying while on the waiting list, or being removed from the waiting list without a transplant, or still on the waiting list at the end of the follow-up. During this time, there were 280,000 plus kidney transplant candidates who were included in the study, and the mean age at waitlisting was 51 years, just slightly more. Male patients were predominant. Of this number, 81,000 plus received actually a deceased donor kidney. 11% of them received a living donor allograft. 9.3% died while on the waiting list, and 21% plus were removed from the waiting list. It turns out that people who died while on the waiting list received a median of 16 offers of a kidney over 651 days. Most of these kidneys, 84%, were declined on behalf of the candidate by the center, without, by the way, the patient's knowledge, while those who actually received a deceased donor allograft had a median of 17 offers of a kidney over 422 days while they were on the waiting list. The offers were only very infrequently refused because of patient-related factors, like the patient's condition was temporarily worse and they were thought to perhaps be a poor candidate for surgery. Most of the time, these centers rejected the organ because they perceived the kidney as not of high quality.
These donor kidneys, they're not offered to the patient, they're offered to the center. And the center can either accept them or not. And what you're telling us is that the persons who are on the waiting list died on the waiting list, waiting for a kidney, had 16 offers, but the center refused them. And even, by the way, even those who got a kidney, they had 17 previous offers, 16 declined before that patient got the kidney. Is that what you're telling us?
That's exactly what I'm telling you. And that is without the knowledge of the patient. The patient has no idea that these kidneys are being offered, and they are.
Embedded in this article is a graph that shows all 50 states and how often a kidney was declined in that state and what was the odds of that person dying on the waiting list. And it stretches all the way from Maine, only 5 times the kidney declined, and it's got the lowest mortality. You work your way all the way up to Mississippi, Georgia, even California, where there's 25 to 30 different declines. And by the way, that mortality is 2.5 or 3 times higher. So declining kidneys isn't in the best interest of the patient. I can understand where everybody wants a perfect kidney so that the outcome looks good, but we're talking about dealing with patients' lives here. And it's better, clearly better, to have a transplant than to not have a transplant. By the way, these things are being preserved in cold fluid, and the longer they're preserved, the less likely they are to be successful. So if we're calling around 15 or 16 or 17 times trying to find an adequate recipient, it makes the kidney less desirable as well.
Well, one other thing I think is important to note that they talk about in this study is that people who died while on the waiting list compared with those in the other groups were older, more likely to have diabetes or vascular disease, and less likely to be waitlisted before dialysis initiation. And the other factor that we know, and this segues us into the study that you're going to talk about that's in the Journal of the American Medical Association, is this initiation of dialysis. And when a patient is on dialysis, their outcomes are not as good as patients who are waitlisted before the initiation of dialysis. So let's move to yours.
And it looks at the association between who owns the dialysis center and access to kidney transplantation. Dialysis centers can be owned by for-profit organizations, and that's a $70 billion a year business, or not-for-profit organizations. There was some concern that the for-profit dialysis centers actually had lower kidney transplantation rates. To address whether that was true or not, these investigators looked at almost 1.5 million patients, a median age of 66, who had kidney disease. Not only kidney disease, but were receiving dialysis. 87% of them received it at a for-profit dialysis center. What they determined is, first of all, very few people were put on the deceased donor waiting list, only about 8%. Only about 1.6% received a living donor kidney transplant, and 3.3% received a deceased donor kidney transplant. But if the patient was receiving their dialysis at a for-profit center, they were much less likely to be either referred for transplantation or even to be put on the list, a 40 to 50% decrease.
This, of course, sounds really bad. Sounds like an indictment of this industry. Sounds like they're totally vested in keeping folks on dialysis rather than moving them to transplant, which would clearly get them off dialysis.
Well, for one thing, I think it needs to be regulated. We have to clearly document that the patients have the adequate information. If they don't refer patients, you can cut the money because a lot of this is paid from Medicare and/or Medicaid, so we can directly influence this.
Well, I, for one, would like to see patients get involved in this whole discussion, too. I think both of these studies illustrate the fact that patients need to become aware of these issues and advocate for themselves.
And so for our listeners who either are on dialysis or have a relative or friend on dialysis, the education about the importance of transplant and also looking at what the transplant characteristics are in your particular state about whether they decline or accept more kidneys for transplant, I think is really important.
Okay, so get out there and advocate. Let's stay in the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is a research letter, actually, that's taking a look at what does herd immunity look like now that we've had HPV, human papillomavirus, immunizations underway for some time. Herd immunity is, of course, that immunity that's conferred by a large number of people in a certain population having been vaccinated, and it confers protection to those people who haven't been vaccinated. In this case, this HPV vaccination, they took a look at it in U.S. men and women aged 18 to 59 years between 2009 and 2016 with comparisons of oral HPV prevalence for four of the vaccine types that are part of the vaccination and 33 non-vaccine types. They conducted it across four cycles of NHANES, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. They obtained oral rinses that were evaluated for the presence of HPV, and they used PCR, polymerase chain reaction, to take a look at all of these 37 viral types. They had almost 14,000 participants in that age group. The vaccination rate increased from 0% to 5.8% in men and from 7.3% to 15.1% in women during that time. They were able to show that the prevalence of HPV declined from 2.7% 2009 to 2010 to 1.6% in unvaccinated men only. In unvaccinated women, the prevalence remained unchanged for the vaccine types. And they speculate that the lack of herd protection toward oral HPV infections in unvaccinated women could be a low statistical power because of the low prevalence in women. But I'm going to look at this study with a lot more positive interpretation and say it's yet one more reason to have HPV vaccination and even catch-up vaccination, as has recently been promoted by the CDC.
I find this a very interesting study because since 2006, we've recommended HPV vaccinations for young U.S. females to prevent cervical cancer. Since 2011, we recommended it for males to prevent anogenital HPV-induced cancer. Now we're talking about looking at it in HPV infection of the oral pharynx. In this particular case, it decreased oral pharyngeal HPV infections by 37% in unvaccinated individuals. We can markedly decrease cervical cancer, anogenital cancers, and probably oral pharyngeal cancers as well.
Okay, let's turn to your final one. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine, a new agent for depression.
About 1 in 6 individuals in the United States will have a serious mental health condition during their lifetime. About 7% of the U.S. population in any given year, and major depressive disorders is one of those. And we have a number of medications that are about 60% effective in treating major depressive disorders. But the bad thing is, oftentimes it takes weeks, usually 4 weeks, for these things to become effective. Well, there's another pathway that may be involved called the glutamate pathway. And the major receptor there is gamma-aminobutyric acid. So there's a new agent. It's an oral agent called SAGE, SAGE-217. This is a phase 2 trial, 89 individuals who received 2 weeks of oral therapy. And they looked at whether the depression was changed in that 2-week period. And they stopped the medication and looked for another couple weeks after that. And what they discovered was that the medication was in fact effective in treating the major depressive disorder. And there was benefits within days. Now, when they stopped the medication, the benefits waned. This will evolve into a larger randomized trial to see whether people with major depressive disorder benefit from this. It would be nice to know for those that are recalcitrant to our current therapies, whether these people would benefit from this or what the side effect profile looks like. There were no major adverse events.
So I'm just wondering, have we all been asleep at the switch? Gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA, well-known neurotransmitter, why hasn't anybody been paying attention to its role in major depression previously?
Well, Elizabeth, we actually have, but it's required the use of IV medications like ketamine, for example. This is an oral agent, rapidly effective, again, in a small study, very promising.
No doubt we'll be doing more on this one. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.